We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. From the campaign to save Gertie the Duck to the function of baby hammocks, the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee mines hidden gems of local history. UW-Milwaukee academics are teaming up with other experts to prepare both online and print copies, and they're set for release in 2017. The digital version will be interactive. UWM history professor Dr. Amanda Seligman is the project's leader. She explained to Lake Effect's Amy Kiley the purpose of the encyclopedia.
We really had a vision to share Milwaukee's history with people of the area in a really systematic fashion. We want people to be able to find what they're interested in at short notice, whether it's in a print version or an online version. We want to make the information about Milwaukee's past available to people for a whole variety of reasons.
In the era when scholars volunteer for Wikipedia and write blogs, why did your colleagues and you feel creating a new source was better than augmenting an existing one?
We wanted to have a go-to starting point for people who were doing research on Milwaukee history. So, you know, blogs are created over time. People put things in according to their whimsy. And it's not systematic. It doesn't show the whole of Milwaukee in a really kind of rigorous fashion to people. Wikipedia is not about Milwaukee. And Wikipedia, while it's a wonderful source in many ways, is not written by experts. It's not edited by experts. Anyone can contribute to Wikipedia, and you can't interpret. You can't trust that what you've written stays there. So when putting together the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee, we wanted to really make an authoritative statement about what we know and what we think we can know about Milwaukee's history in the 21st century.
What does compiling such a work entail, and how long will the process take?
Oh, it's a huge job. It's actually a 10-year project. We started working on it in 2008, and there were a couple of years of planning, and we are projecting a publication date of 2017. The work involved is large-scale project management. So we had to think about, how do you create the website? How do you create the book? How do you find graduate students who can write a bunch of entries? How do you commission entries from non-graduate student people out in the community who are experts on their particular topics? How do you plan the contents, including figuring out exactly what should be in and how long everything should be? And how do you keep a project going over a 10-year period? So there's all sorts of tasks that are involved in putting together this project. Oh, yes, and of course, there's fundraising as well.
To accomplish all that, what are the roles or job descriptions involved in the process?
Well, we have a very large team of people who are working on this, doing the different tasks. We have a core editorial team. That's myself and my colleague Margot Anderson, who have been planning the project from the beginning. We seated an editorial board consisting of local experts in Milwaukee history that include archivists, librarians, other history faculty members from Marquette, and John Gerda, who is, of course, Mr. Milwaukee History. We also have a core of graduate student staff who are working on it. There's an IT team who's working on it. There's development people who are working on it. The list kind of goes on and on.
Can you talk about why you received a $250,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the costs of what you're doing?
Like I said, it's a huge project. And when I suggested who all those people were who were involved in it, that you have to compensate them. You can't get graduate students, for example, to work on a project for free. They need to be able to support themselves while they're going to school and also have a little bit to live on and et cetera. So the costs for the project add up to about $2 million. Every time we've tweaked the budget one way or another, it still ends up around $2 million. So we knew that in order to make the project possible, we had to raise funds for it. And so when we began planning seriously in 2009, we had our eye on a particular program that's hosted by the National Endowment for the Humanities that would allow us to really do a lot of work on the project. So that's why we seated that editorial board, to really plan the contents and think about what would exactly go into the grant application we gave to the National Endowment for the Humanities. And we also convinced the university to offer up quite a bit of funding in cost shares in the event that we got the grant. So we are able to pay graduate students and other staff, commission maps, have images, write entries, and plan the website all using those funds.
Some of the elements you just named are multimedia. How does the online version of the encyclopedia make use of that format in terms of digitized primary source materials and things like that?
As I suggested, we do have two versions of the project, a print version and a digital version. The digital version is going to have everything that's in the print edition and then some extra special features. We're pretty book-oriented, so we think of them using these kind of bookish terms that we made up, but we don't usually use them in public. I'll let you know what they are today. They're the underbook and the overbook. But you won't see that when you go to the website. What you'll see when you go to the website is a button next to an entry that says, "Want to know more?" And if you push that button, you'll get access to those special features. The overbook lets you know about how other people who have read in the project think about it and lets you have the opportunity to leave comments yourself. So we'll be able to see what readers really think of the project, where they think we made mistakes, I hope not too many, what they think of when they look at the topic that they're reading about. And we hope that they'll also provide more information than we were able to put into a short authoritative entry. I've been really impressed on our Facebook page. People want to share information. People are hungry to share the information they have about the past. And so the overbook will be a place where people can see what has been said by other people and fill in those gaps they think are there and contribute their own ideas. The underbook, by contrast, has the mission of teaching readers where historical information comes from. How do we know what we know about the past? And there's going to be a couple things that will happen. When they hit that button that turns on the underbook, the first thing they're going to get are footnotes. So if you think about a standard encyclopedia entry, just imagine it in your mind's eye. You might see an author's name attached to it, but you won't see where the information comes from. So the first thing we want to show readers is the information in an encyclopedia was not just handed down from on high with no author to it, but that the person who did the research went somewhere, looked for that information, and put it together. So that's one feature, is the footnotes. We're also going to digitize primary sources that are held in our wonderful local archives so that teachers, for example, who want to teach about a particular topic in Milwaukee history also have some primary sources that their students can work with and say, oh, that's really how that knowledge that's in that primary source went into the writing about it as well. And then finally, the feature that we're kind of most excited about is what we call understories. Again, a very awkward name for something we think is pretty cool. These are stories about how the researchers and writers for the project experienced the research process. So let me just give one example of that. We have a really great undergraduate student who's working with us right now, and she was invited into the home of a postcard collector in Shorewood. And she spent a couple of weeks sitting with this collection of pre-World War II postcards featuring Milwaukee history. And there was one picture that really arrested her attention. It was a picture of what she called baby hammocks. It was cribs suspended from a ceiling. It startled us, I think, in the 21st century, because clearly that does not meet 21st century safety standards. You would not allow babies to hang out in a place that they could just climb out of and fall on the ground. But she kept coming back to them, and she wanted to know what these baby hammocks were. But it was impossible for her to research something that was a picture with a word that she made up attached to it. So she was talking to everyone about it. And she and I were talking about it one day, and it finally dawned on me, you know, there's a book we have that describes something that might be connected to that. And when she looked at the book, she said, oh, this is a fresh air pavilion for babies and mothers, gives mothers a little respite, and also prevents tuberculosis in the early 20th century. So then she was able, once she had the actual term for what it was a fresh air pavilion, then she was able to go out and find more information about it. So she's written a wonderful understory about that research process that will show the stops and starts that researchers experience. When you put something in an encyclopedia, you don't put it there just because you knew it off the top of your head, but you really had to work hard to find it, and that's one example of how that happens.
What are the advantages and challenges of starting with both digital and hard copy formats versus digitizing from an existing print resource?
So that's a great question. We were initially thinking that we would just do a print edition because we knew that there were extra costs attached to doing an online project, but we really wanted to make this information available to the public. But there isn't funding available for straight print projects anymore. When we went to the National Endowment for the Humanities just to talk about the project, they said, you know, if you're going to get funding from us, it has to be digital. So then we began to think about how do these two kinds of sources for the public interact? What are the different things they would do for readers? One thing that the print edition does is it will last forever, right? That as long as it's preserved in a library, people can always go look up what's there. Whereas stuff that's online, formats may change. You have to update your website. The university is committed to this project, but what happens if there's radical changes that we don't quite catch up with? The print edition is a way of making something permanent. It's also really tangible. People really love to touch these books. There's other city encyclopedias for other cities around the United States. And when I take them to show people, people spend a lot of time just flipping through them, really interacting with the images that they see. And that really speaks to me about how important it is to have a book available for people, even in the 21st century. We know that people will use this in a really intimate way in their homes, and we want to make that book available to them. Younger people, of course, are more likely to go to the digital edition, right? Not every school is going to be able to afford to purchase a coffee table book for every classroom for, where they might want to study Milwaukee history. And having a website available 24/7 will allow students and teachers and anyone else who uses the internet to find the information that they need when they need it.
Finally, what are one to three things you learned about Milwaukee during this project that surprised you that you didn't know before?
Oh, you know, we're still sort of in the middle of the project, so I haven't learned all the things that there are to learn. We've put so much energy into planning it. I'll tell you that one of my favorite stories that I pull out all the time is about Gertie the Duck. I don't know if you know about Gertie. A lot of people who lived through this remember it, but then younger people don't necessarily. Gertie was a duck at the end of World War II who laid her eggs in a very inconvenient spot where her eggs were in danger right along the river. And the whole city rallied around rescuing those eggs and putting them in a safer location. And this became – it transfixed the city. And you can imagine the time when everybody is so war-weary in 1945 and they want to have something to distract them from the bad times. And Gertie the Duck functioned to pull people in the city together to think about something else that they actually could accomplish. Ultimately, of course, the United States prevailed in World War II, but Milwaukeeans could get a real sense of being able to do something together with that little duck and her family. And, you know, there were books written about Gertie the Duck, and I went and pulled one out of the public library recently to show my own kids. They weren't too interested because they didn't understand yet how significant it is. But I love to tell people that story because I think it illustrates that there's things about Milwaukee that are really interesting stories that didn't happen anywhere else but also have a peek at bigger things that were going on in the world.
Right here at Water in Wisconsin, where our studios are, there's a sculpture or a brass sculpture, I guess, of a duck. That seems kind of random. Is that Gertie?
That's Gertie.
So you come to visit WUWM and you can meet Gertie.
Right, exactly.
Well, Dr. Amanda Seligman, thank you for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
UWM's Dr. Amanda Seligman is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley.